now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Dean Haglund, is it possible that that will be the last time people are treated to the Down Under version of the theme to Chilpack Hollywood Hour?
I think so. My day is rapidly approaching when I get on a plane with a one-way ticket straight out of here.
Now, what happens if U.S. Customs doesn't allow you back in?
That well, that's an excellent point. Let's see. Luckily, I have that fully automated robot global entry program. So I just have to touch it. It reads all my fingerprints, and then a camera takes my picture. So I never actually talk to a customs agent when I travel anymore, which is sad. You don't get your passport stamped. But at the same time, man, it speeds things up.
But what if you've been red flagged? I mean, they're not going to strip you from your children and put you in cages, I don't think. But you never know.
You never know. That's true.
You got to pay extra for that. But would you, I don't know, why am I even talking such a crazy hypothetical?
I don't know what I would.
But I'm curious as to whether you go back to Australia at that point or you go to Canada. That's what I'm wondering. Anyway.
I would think Canada because I don't have a place to. I'm in a Holiday Inn in Warwick Farm, Chippy Norton area.
Oh God, we're gonna have to change our announcement because. I guess guests of Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Hosts nice. Of Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the what is it? The Holiday Inn in where?
Chippy Norton or Warwick Farm. Technically, it's Warwick Farm. It's right on the border of Chippy Norton, where they say, hey, welcome to Warwick Farm. At least we're not Chippy Norton.
Do you have any more bucket list items that you have either accomplished since I last spoke to you a week ago or that you plan on crossing off in the next handful of days?
Handful of days. Well, coming up on Instagram, on my Instagram, is all the paintings that I've been doing. And there's only 4 pages left in this book of paintings that I got to complete in a day and a half. Can I do it? Oh, right now it's sunny, and you just cost me an hour because you didn't realize it was daylight saving time here. So, yeah, that bucket list, that's going to happen. Of course, I finally did the bridge climb, amazingly. Which happened on a day when they said the weather's going to be atrocious. And we got there and the clouds parted and it was sunny. And so everyone else had canceled except for one other couple. So it was a mere 4 people plus a guide up on the top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which apparently is very rare. Normally there are groups of 14 and you're crammed in and you march up there. We had an hour to ourselves because there were no other tour groups either side of us. And then when the 3 started marching down, I stayed up there for a couple minutes by myself on top of the Sydney Bridge, just all by myself, the wind blowing through my hair and just looking around. I think that experience is probably unique to almost everyone. You rarely by yourself on top of a bridge on the iconic Sydney waterfront.
That's certainly a good way to close out the Down Under chapter of your life.
It certainly is. Yes, you take a moment to ponder in silence everything that you've seen and done and where you've been and where you're going.
Would my fear of heights been kicked in? Would my spider senses have been tingling up at that height? Or was it not? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's a couple parts where actually on the lower part of the bridge, you have to walk along some gangplanks where you can actually see down not only to the water, but to the roadway. So you start fairly in, then you walk about 200-300 feet before you climb a couple thin ladders to get to the beginning of the arch. Once you're on the arch, it's really wide and there's stairs, and so that part's easy. But getting there, that's a little precarious and on some thin see-through gangplanks.
Well, I'm going to use that as a segue into live events of the week because, boy, do I have a live event to tell you about.
Excellent.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
So last week was the 100th birthday celebration of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. A day-long festival of music and dance that stretched all the way between the LA Phil's two iconic homes, Walt Disney Concert Hall in downtown Los Angeles and the Hollywood Bowl. There were people that participated all 8 miles, marched or bicycled all 8 miles, music performances along the entire route. Yours truly managed to walk all the way from the Hollywood Highland Red Line station up to his terrace seats where he enjoyed a lovely meal, waiting for the show to begin at the Hollywood Bowl. And this 100th...
Wait. Yeah. You didn't walk?
I didn't do any of the other part. No. But I know people who did, and you may feel free to do podcasts with them. but this 100th anniversary of the LA Phil at the Hollywood Bowl was, spectacular gets thrown around too much, but it truly was a spectacle. It's sometimes a hilarious spectacle. Other times a downright inspiring one. It begins. It actually, honestly, musically, the highlight was the first number. It's unfair to say that it kind of tapered off from there because all the big stars came after that, but I'm just saying musically, the most stirring performance was that of Arturo Marquez's Conga del Fuego Nuevo, and it was performed by not only the LA Phil under the conducting of Gustavo Dudamel, of course, but by the Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, who played alongside them, and it was fantastic. It was one of the best pieces of live music I have ever seen performed.
Wow. That's cool.
From there, they went to Paul Desen's a world premiere of an LA Phil commission of an orchestral piece by Paul Desen, Guasama Cabra. And then another big highlight for me, which was, and I had seen the LA Phil perform this before there at the Hollywood Bowl, but the entire piece. But they did the finale from the Firebird, Stravinsky's The Firebird.
Of course,
Oh, what a piece of music this is. That.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, my God. That is, it's crazy how good that is and how intricate that is. And then the first act ended with some vocal performances backed by the LA Phil and Gustavo Dudamel by, I guess, a very popular recording artist from South America. First time I'd ever seen her perform. Kali Uchis is the woman's name. And, I guess internationally quite popular. So,
sure.
Right there, that's a show. You know? That's a that
you would think
you if you applause. Went you went home then you would be satisfied. Of course, a lot of people didn't show up till then because they were coming for, you know, the important stuff, which was after the intermission. Now, don't get me wrong. Seeing one of my musical heroes, jazz great, legendary film composer, and the chair, by the way, the jazz chair of the LA Phil for the past several years, Herbie Hancock.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Big deal.
Performing his seminal, groundbreaking MTV hit, Rocket, 35 Rocket. Years after its premiere with the original scratcher, the original grand mixer, DXT, on stage, performing with him.
Wow.
Backed, yes, by the entire LA Phil. That was some cool shit for me.
There you go. Okay. That's a big deal.
And leads into the part of the evening that people will be talking about for years to come, because nothing says happy birthday, LA Phil, like a mini concert by Katy Perry.
Oh, so, no.
So she comes out and she does a set backed by the LA Phil under the, you know, conducting of Gustavo Dudamel. She even says that this all came about 6 months earlier when she was in Argentina, I think it was, and he was conducting a performance by the Argentinian Symphony Orchestra. And,
right.
And Katy Perry actually tells this. She says, it was the first orchestral concert I'd ever been to.
Great.
Really great. So by all means, pick this person to celebrate all that is the LA Phil. Anyway, her song Firework could not have been more perfectly chosen, since there was one of the most amazing fireworks presentations ever.
What?
During the highlights.
In the Hollywood Bowl?
Oh, they do fireworks regularly with the LA Phil. And what's cool about it is that a lot of times Dudamel has control over them.
Okay.
So while conducting.
When I saw July 4th, Kenny Rogers, Hollywood Bowl, the fireworks were not only lame, they were curtailed because of fire season.
No,
they were worried all the brush fire would just burst in flames.
Fireworks spectaculars are amazing, and they get bigger and better each year.
God, now I'm pissed.
But look, the two words that explain why you should be pissed and mournful and regretful, Kenny Rogers. So anyway,
July 4th, Kenny Rogers.
I guess I understand why people are fans of Katy Perry, and I am not so jaded that I would not say that I am glad that I saw her perform. I am glad that I can say from here on out in my life, you know what? I once saw Katy Perry perform live and probably saw her in a venue that I would enjoy her the most, and with backing that cannot be beat, obviously.
Right. There you go.
That said, I doubt I will ever hear another piece of music she's ever done again. So, but never, never say never, right? Anyway, then, right. And that's much how I feel about the encore. Now, again, remember, this is an encore celebrating 100 years of the LA Phil. So who would be conducting the LA Phil? But John Williams. Not Gustavo Dudamel, not Esa-Pekka Salonen. It's John Williams. And what would they play? The Star Wars suite.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, you know, okay, so that's a big seller for them, of course. The music of John Williams has been very successful at the Hollywood Bowl, funding many of the seasons of the LA Phil. So, while I hear the jaded what the hellness voice.
I'm not so jaded again that I wouldn't say that it was cool to have seen that. And John Williams probably will not be with us for much longer. So, though again, it's fascinating. He's one of these guys. I think you and I have talked about this before. Like when I saw Ella Fitzgerald at the Bowl, a bit of a frail might be overdoing it. But I mean, just the simple step up, you know, to conduct the orchestra, he needed help. He's a man of a certain age, but once the music starts, once the music fills him, just so much vitality, right? But that said, you know, he's all our days are numbered. he's going first. And so I'm glad that I guess I got the chance to see him conducting such a spectacular orchestra. But, you know, let's face it, the music doesn't compare, again, to Stravinsky's The Firebird. And it, you know, you walk away after all those hours going, wow, part of me wishes the show had ended after the Youth Orchestra of L.A. had left the stage after the first song, because that would have been a perfect evening. But I want to tell you about something else that went there at the Bowl for this, and I'd never seen them do this before. They turned the entire venue into a graphical presentation varied based on what piece they were doing. For example, with the Firebird, there was projection animation everywhere with the bird itself coming to life.
Not just on the white shell in the background, but
mostly
everywhere.
There, but then also on other walls and things like this. But when I say everywhere, they cajoled, begged, pleaded, bullied, shamed most of the audience into downloading an app so that everyone's mobile phones and activate your Bluetooth so that your mobile phones could be taken over by the production. And all the smartphones became a part of the graphical display.
Wow. Wait a sec. So I hold the screen toward, what do I?
Yeah. Some would hold it towards the stage. Others would hold it backwards for the people behind them. But the whole bowl lit up and was activated as part of the various graphical displays at various times throughout the evening. And it on a scale of effectiveness in terms of, you know, how cool this is for the presentation, maybe a 4 or a 5. You know, it was fun a couple times, but as an effective tool of keeping people off their goddamn phones throughout the evening, a 10 out of 10. Nobody annoying me, first of all, and foremost of all, by taking photos or by filming the thing, holding up their cameras and videoing it, right? People actually had to stay present. And oh, by the way, they didn't have control over their phones. So it was brilliant. That is a brilliant way to turn an abject negative of the live theater going experience into a potential positive.
Ah, that's pretty good. I'm going to give that kudos. And if that technology can be further developed, I see big potential for all sorts of crowd interaction, phone app, linky presentational stuff.
Oh my
God.
That's
pretty good.
Your one-man X-Files shows have been transformed. You need to get in touch with the geniuses at Xcite Labs. That's capital X, I-T-E. I mean, it's One Man X-Files and Xcite Labs. It is a marriage made in Hollywood.
Fantastic. I'm loving it.
The reason we're coming at people a little bit late today, other than you being in a border town somewhere in a Holiday Inn, is that last night I hosted a tribute to Leo Carrillo and the Old West at Friendship Auditorium in Los Feliz here.
It was Leo Carrillo and the Old West.
It was a fundraiser for the Breakfast Club, and it was so much fun. We started with a lot of authentic Western music. We had a good old-fashioned chili cook-off with a number of entries during the intermission, and then at the end I gave a historic presentation about Mr. California. At one time, no doubt, California's most beloved son, Leo Carrillo, a great Western star who's remembered best to this day for playing Pancho on the Cisco Kid when he was 70 years old, for crying out loud. But what a life this guy led. And if people are interested in learning more, I'll drop some stuff about that on a future episode of the Breakfast Club podcast. But it's always pretty cool to get to. I was actually saying, Dean, that in addition to this podcast, if I could do nothing else but teach acting intensives and give presentations on the historic members of the Breakfast Club, Like, if I could figure out how to just turn those three things into a career, I'd be a very, very happy man.
Wow. Okay. Let it start to
it's fun.
Rubbing the chin.
You know, digging into the research. I mean, I read Leo Carrillo's biography, a memoir, a love story about California. I mean, how about this opening line? The adobe is my birthstone. Is the opening line
wow.
of his book, The California I Love, which was published a week before his death in 1961. Anyway, so that was great fun, and of course there's going to be a big Breakfast Club variety show set in the final hour of 1949 coming up at the end of November that I am producing, writing, and will host, and I'll share those details down the line.
Ah, that sounds like fun.
Hey, I've been wanting to ask you, did you ever get into Stranger Things?
You know, I didn't. I watched the first couple of episodes. I thought the writing was a bit clunky for my taste and sort of left it there. However, it seemed to have legs and caught everyone's or some people's imagination. So clearly I need to learn more about this Stranger Things.
Well, I was curious. I watched the first season and it wasn't in any hurry to watch season two, but I have watched it. And I was curious because it didn't seem to me that season two was the cultural must-see that season one was. But then again, we live in a time where the new thing really seems to get a lot of attention, right?
And, right, yep.
And I'm curious about that phrase, that the writing seemed clunky. because I'm wondering about that. You know... let's face it, the writers are so dependent upon, they have the least control in many ways over how something turns out. I mean, if the script doesn't work, that dog won't hunt, period. But if the script does work, that dog still might not hunt because many good scripts have been ruined.
right.
And I'm mostly just comparing season two to season one, and season one had charms and thrills to it and everything. But what I like about season two, aside from the fact that overall the episodes are better, although it does have the single worst episode of the entire run, it's a truly dreadful hour of television. And the season itself, one episode longer. Hello, I have an idea of which one you could cut. did feel padded, as let's face it, sometimes television shows do.
Right.
But what I liked about it was this season seemed not nearly so much to be about the 80s. It seemed just to be a story set in the 80s.
Ah, see, now we like that, as opposed to showing off details, period details that we like so much.
Well, this is what I was wondering. Is it possible that this kind of desire to make something that could have been made in the 80s, which is what J.J. Abrams did with that movie Super 8, which people raved about. And then it came out and it was like, meh. You know, if you're still stuck there wishing that everybody else made things like that, then, yeah, you loved it. But if you moved along, even if you had affection for that, see, because I have affection for the time period. I came of age during that time period, but I don't want people making things like they made them then.
Right.
And but if you're going to set something then, okay, that's great if that's the right time for the story. And I feel like there was such an emphasis in the first season on making it seem like this could have been made then that effort may have weighed heavy on the writing itself. It may have overshadowed the writing. Is that possible?
Interesting. That is possible, because if you are taught, are you not, in all your artistic pursuits to pursue your passion. And if you are passionate for details of the 80s, you are going to eschew the actual fundamentals of storytelling and writing and dialogue, which it felt like what the, to me, particularly dialogue, I thought was ringing so tinny to me that I couldn't get past it, regardless of how much they were embracing historical period detail, both in production and in set design. But
well, and
you
if you're going to write something that's set a certain time, okay, fine. Watch the movies, watch the popular culture of that time. Hear how people were talking then, because absolutely, especially something that's focusing on young people, those young people are taking their cues at that time from movies. I don't think the kids that same age today are taking their cues from movies. They're taking them from, I don't know, K-pop or from the Disney Channel or
video games,
you know, whatever it is. But but at that time, absolutely. And so you can have a pretty effective handle on the vernacular that young people used back then by watching the movies that young people were watching, because a generation after generation, people, young people, have always in some way emulated their big screen heroes, right? I think that you're okay. You're on safe enough footing doing that as a writer. But if you're then going to make something that compounds that by now, I'm going to shoot it the way they would have shot it then.
Right.
You're already in danger of gilding the lily at best, and at most weighing it down as some kind of thought experiment. And not, breathing any kind of life into it.
That to me is the key word. Breathing life into it. To me, it had it had joy, but no life somehow. Like the life was struck out of it by its joy of being in the 80s somehow.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
So I'd be curious, even if it was just a comparison of you watching like episode one of season one and then episode one of season two. I mean, I guess the plot, you'd be kind of lost, but it really did feel markedly different to me. And the show, of course, is helped by the fact that the young leads, many of the leads in the show are very young people. Boy, a year later, they've really developed as actors, as we saw happen, right, with the Harry Potter kids, right? They grew into their roles and into, their acting abilities. That's happened in this show to a significant degree as well.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, this is one of those cases, just like Twin Peaks, I will now take another look at it with a jaded eye.
Now, what about this? I'm about to turn my attention to what just dropped, which is season 3 of The Man in the High Castle. Now, you gave up on this, or did you?
I did.
You did? Okay.
Well, I gave up on it. I mean, I shifted my limited time to other palettes, shall we say.
That's the greatest breakup letter that I've ever I'm not so much breaking up with you as can we get that in a Hallmark card? I'm shifting my romantic attention to other palettes.
I'm sure you understand. You are still within the color range that I use, and
why is it that I'm drawn to this like moth to flame, and this does not attract you or excite you? Science fiction, Philip K. Dick, an alternate a depiction of an alternate past. What is it? Why am I drawn to this? Despite its flaws, and why are you nonplussed by what I would think would be its obvious attraction for you?
Yeah, well, as a World War II buff as a kid, I had read numerous, at least three alternative revisionist history where America was taken over by Nazis, where they didn't win the war. And so I thought the genre was already well trodden.
Too soon.
Was it too soon? Yeah. Yeah. So I guess not too soon, but the, but I thought, oh, you know, a delightful that hadn't been seen on the medium screen, as we call it. But, yeah, I guess I had, already enjoyed that trope. And it had already left the station for me.
Interesting.
But that's me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I'm not saying no to it. I'm just saying my limited time with the palettes and all that sort of thing. You understand.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm so captured by the premise of it that I feel like even when an episode isn't very good, you know, there's I'm enjoying exploring the premise. That's really it.
Yeah. You know? Well, and did you not read? Now I can't. It's a shame. I read three different novels, and they were like paperback war fiction. You know, often I would buy them just for their catchy covers. And one, was it called Ultra Secret? Was a revisionist history one? I can't remember.
I'll pick up a copy next time I'm at Booksmith Quality Used Books. They're in Nelson, BC.
Yes, I'm sure they will line them up.
Hey,
so anyway,
do you want to do a lawsuit of the week?
No, do I?
The Chill Pack Hollywood lawsuit of the week.
This is a good one, Dean. This is a really good one involving, I don't know, names in the news, but also legendary Hollywood persona.
Okay.
After more than a year of fighting, FX and Ryan Murphy, the creator of Glee and the creator of American Horror Story and so many others, after fighting them over her depiction in Feud, the miniseries about Joan Crawford and Bette Davis, Olivia de Havilland has kept her word and is taking her lawsuit to the Supreme Court of the United States of America.
Ooh, wow. That is a doozy.
We must persevere and speak truth to power, the 102-year-old two-time Oscar winner said as her attorneys petitioned SCOTUS in the ongoing legal battle. The fight is itself important to the principle of honesty, so much in need today in the face of deliberate public confusion for selfish agendas, she added in a statement from her Paris home. Her legal attacks have suffered a number of legal setbacks and defeats since she originally filed her lawsuit in June 2017. But basically, she is seeking to have the nation's highest court reexamine what jurisdictions in California have decided. And it all involves, First Amendment precedent and what rights an individual has to the way they are depicted, right?
Historically. Yes.
Yes.
In biopics and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Are reckless or knowing false statements about a living public figure published in docudrama format entitled to absolute First Amendment protection from claims based on the victim's statutory and common law causes of action for defamation and right of publicity so as to justify dismissal at the pleading stage. That's what asks the petition. I watched some of it. Some of it.
And you overall, I know where she's coming from on this. Do you?
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Yes.
I mean, I never bought this as realistic in any way. I mean,
no.
This seemed to be, I don't know, how would you describe it? I mean, almost kind of this fun, fever
cartoony
dream of, yeah, let's lampoon it, let's make it cartoony. The kind of thing that could have been a cool play, and you would have not named the characters. You would have given them an attribution, and everyone would have known. There was a Nicholas Roeg film called Insignificance about a rumored meeting at a hotel that may or may not have taken place between Albert Einstein, Marilyn Monroe, Joe DiMaggio, and Joe McCarthy back in the 50s. Right. And in Nicholas Roeg's Insignificance, which I think was a play originally, the characters are named the Starlet, the Slugger, the Senator, the Scientist. You know who they are, but they're used as kind of these cultural touchstones to explore lots of different themes. And, and that's cool. I think that's fun. That's the way to do it, right? But to give the impression that this is what happened, especially when some of these people are still alive, well, shouldn't you have to have responsibility for that?
Yes, well, but if as a writer, which Ryan Murphy is, he is taking artistic license, which is, I'm now having more and more trouble with that phrase all the time, but he's taking artistic license because he needs narrative, structural components placed in there to drive the story forward just to make it work. So, yeah, suddenly somebody has to be a little harsher. Somebody has to be the bad guy, the good guy. You're painting your swath in a much larger brush, which then removes some of the subtleties, the nuances on a lot of these characters, which, I mean, really, if this wasn't such a cartoony, lampoony thing, he wouldn't have to done. He could have put in the nuances. He could have added to the truth of it and explored that deeper. But clearly the producers and everybody didn't want that.
Well, it also strikes me that one thing he could have done is reach out to her and ask her if she has any problem with being a part of this in the first place. I mean, the woman is still alive, and no one obtained or sought even her permission to depict her or use her name in the show. And because these are supposedly real events, they don't have to. These are events of public record. So therefore, they can use her name. But once you're fictionalizing those events of public record, I go back to point A, how do you not have to get the person's permission then?
Yes, because you're fictionalizing public record.
Yeah.
I guess, right? If I say Nixon was impeached and he was fired. Yeah.
This becomes a fascinating Supreme Court decision. Are they going to hear the case? First of all, you'd kind of think that on behalf of 102-year-old Olivia de Havilland, star of Gone With the Wind.
Yeah, I know.
They're probably going to want to at least hear the case. But also, even though the California Supreme Court refused to hear it altogether, a now cemented conservative majority, and not just, as we know, to run the risk of dipping into politics on this thing,
right,
a fifth conservative member of the court was just sworn in who declared open season on Democrats and liberals, which are very much how the rest of the country sees California. I wouldn't be shocked if that court hears the case just to stick it to California.
Well, that's then... however it gets to court is how it gets to court, regardless of, you know, one's mandate and outside the judicial foyer.
And speaking of the Supreme Court, Dean, there was some furor. There was some controversy over this nomination.
Whoa. What?
Did you hear?
I'm sorry. No, somehow, Australia, we didn't get the daily barrage of what the fuck's going on.
All right. I want to focus on something that's an ongoing theme that we have had about this in relation to what I hope will help support the healing that is so desperately needed in society. I think more people were willing to listen to Dr. Ford in her allegations against Brett Kavanaugh than were willing to even listen to Anita Hill 27 years ago. Now,
very good. That's true.
I think people were willing to listen. I don't think she had to endure. She endured too much. Don't kid yourself. I mean, she got chased out of her home. She got death threats. Her kids can't return to their home. I mean, it's terrible. And it's an improvement over where we were. And many people who were willing to listen and were willing to say that she was credible, nevertheless have struck the case that just because we need to be able to listen, but that doesn't mean we have to believe. And I think, and that's where the conversation is right now, that you either believe him or her. That just because, yes, we should all listen to a victim doesn't mean that we have to believe the victim. And you and I have been down this a lot, and it was something that came up a lot in The Truth Is Out There. That namely, yes, you do have to believe. If you think this person is credible, if you think this person is authentic, you have to believe. But believing doesn't mean you have to give up your agency of control. Belief is simply good manners.
Right.
And
yeah.
And you know, maybe some of the details of what she said are not accurate. And now you can get into debate over when we can't prove something, how much weight should it be given in different contexts? In the context of a job interview, in the context of a court case, in the context of public opinion. Those are all worthy conversations, valid conversations, conversations that can be had by people of good conscience and good nature that will disagree. But there's no reason not to believe. There's no reason not to, right? As we used to talk about with some people, we would come away going, wow, there's no doubt in our mind that, yes, this person had the experience they are describing. If we had been there, the experience might have looked different to us.
Right.
Through our perception. And also
our perception, our perspective.
Also absent the trauma that they endured, the PTSD that they might be suffering, so many things. And and that is why court cases can be so difficult to prove. But it would be nice if we're not all lawyers with each other. If we could just understand that this person had this experience. And they and we know, again, we know all those people who walked away from Dr. Ford's testimony saying this is a disaster for the Republicans. Conservatives saying that this is a disaster until 3 hours later when Brett Kavanaugh screamed bloody murder at everyone and everyone said, oh, no, OK, he's innocent. and you know why? It was because she was authentic. We knew she was speaking her truth.
And
that's period. That's end of statement. You don't have to muddy what you're going to do or how you're going to choose to respond by now giving back your belief or any of that kind of stuff. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Do not give up your agency is the thing. One can believe, but still hold to one's own values. I don't know what else you're holding on to, but. But, yeah.
You still have to live your life, and you have to make your decisions. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. I was confused about that, too. Why, if she's authentic and everybody believes her, then suddenly it's, oh, we can't believe her. Because then he's guilty.
And I hope that we get past this nonsense of, oh, if this was so bad, why didn't they come forward sooner? Why don't people? And as we know from combat to sexual assaults. People who suffered traumatic experiences often do not speak about these experiences for a long time. And the reasons are many and varied and would take another 10 years of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour quickly.
Right.
But they're reasons that are powerful and controlling to the person who has experienced a traumatic thing. And the worst thing you can do to anyone who has experienced a traumatic incident is to tell them what they need to do with it or what they should do with it. You need to realize that often the trauma comes out of losing agency of control, so you do not want to be in a position of, again, taking away their agency of control. And we see time and time again that one of the reasons, of course, that people don't come forward is even when they do come forward, and sometimes come forward in great numbers, the person that they are accusing is either already in power or is about to become president of the United States or is about to become a Supreme Court justice, and now it's open season on you. Now what have you done? I would encourage, in the wake of Me Too, I would encourage this in the wake of the Supreme Court, anyone who has a story to tell about abuse, about something that happened, if you can come forward, come forward. Not just about Brett Kavanaugh, obviously, but about whatever your experience was.
Right.
And I would never tell people they should. All I would say is that if they are ready to, if they want to, we need to create as many safe spaces for them to do that as possible. And one of the reasons is that as long as people remain silent, other people have permission to continue to perpetuate this kind of behavior.
Exactly. So I, it does take the wind out of one's sails at times, but at the same time, as you said, the positive,
well,
more people listen than ever before.
And we clearly, we're a society that likes to measure things in numbers, the box office grosses, for example, right? The Nielsen ratings, the Q rating. We love to measure these, the polls, the approval polls. So let's just use the numbers to show how things have gotten better. This will make everyone feel good. I'm turning lemons into lemonade, everybody. In 1991, despite credible allegations against him, Clarence Thomas was approved, confirmed to the Supreme Court by a vote of 52-48. 27 years later, despite numerous credible accusations against him, again, a man was still confirmed to the Supreme Court, but this time only by a count of 50-48. We've gotten two votes better, America. And it only took 27 years to get there. So what am I saying, Dean? What I'm saying is give it another 27 years and a sexual predator is going to have a hard time getting on the court.
It's a 50-50 chance is what you're saying.
I hope you feel better, America. You're welcome. You know, speaking of so much of what we've been speaking about, box office grosses, and I mean, there's some movies that have come out that I want to talk about.
Yeah, me too.
But before we do, Dean, I watched a movie that an independent film here that got a lot of press during the summer. But one of the reasons it got press was not, I feel, even mostly because it was good, though it is very good. It's because it was released by MoviePass as the distribution entity when MoviePass was facing all these financial struggles. And it's a true crime story called American Animals.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you
this
know
is of a MoviePass releases?
Yes.
Well, I know of it because I've seen the poster. But I, that's about as far as it goes.
Well, what an interesting film to see the same week, we're discussing this Olivia de Havilland lawsuit, because it is a 2018 crime drama based upon the true story of a library heist that happened at Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky in 2004.
Okay. One thing that I did not know Lexington, Kentucky had a Transylvania University.
So here, I didn't know that there was a library heist. $12 million in books stolen. Anyway, but this is from the director who made the fantastic 2012 documentary, The Imposter. So it's a documentary director making a, what will be called a docudrama, basically. Because cast to play the main characters are actors, all of whom are fantastic. Also cast to play them are the real people.
What?
We go from the actors doing scenes to the talking heads telling us what happened and what was going on. And sometimes the lines blur. And sometimes the real people show up in the scenes. It's very cool. And it comments upon so many things, including heist pictures and how heist pictures themselves helped inspire this particular heist. it's a terrific little movie. It is so much fun.
Wow, I'm shocked. Actually,
very funny. Very funny movie. Very funny.
Because it's playing here, but it's not. It seems to be marketed away from what you're saying. Actually. It's sort of, here's a quirky thing, and that's about it.
I had no idea how funny this was going to be. Maybe you put it on your Australian bucket list. Who knows?
Wow. I only got one day. I can't go running around seeing a movie. I got to close bank accounts and shut down my phone.
So before we get into other movies, I want to give these numbers. The top two films that opened at the box office in America this week were Venom, starring Tom Hardy, which made $80 million in its opening weekend, and A Star is Born, which made $44 million in its opening weekend, and both of them photographed by my frequent former collaborator, the great cinematographer, Matt Libatique. Two weekend, shot by the same guy, they open one and two. That's not only amazing and very cool, but that's some range, too, right there.
That's some range. Yeah. He's a busy fella this year.
So I'm guessing that you saw something.
I saw Venom. I saw Venom one last time at the old neighborhood theater.
Wait, you say you saw it one last time, which makes it seem like you'd seen it many times before. Because, by the way... That is true of my relationship with A Star is Born. I saw it again because I'd seen it at least three times before.
Right. You saw the
37,
Chris Christopherson.
The 50s. Yeah, exactly. Anyway. All right. Yeah, so talk to me about what is, without a doubt, I guess, the first, the worst reviewed Marvel big screen movie, but it's not a Marvel Universe movie. It's the Sony Spider-Verse. Nah. So talk to me about this. What went wrong or what went right that people aren't getting?
Let's see. Something did go wrong. And something went wrong in its predictability. You have a bad guy that is Elon Muskish bringing the alien life form back. It gets out of control. Tom Hardy gets infected. He starts to develop a relationship with it. And the two of them go about killing bad guys. That's roughly, in the nutshell, the whole thing. And there is a lot of pipe laid down to get to that story that we get to so much quicker in other Marvel Universe fight, like Infinity Wars. You get good guy, bad guy, everybody's fighting. You think about how you don't really need both Tom Hardy's relationship with the lawyer and the relationship with his boss at his job as a hotshot reporter. I mean, do we need both those relationships laid out so deeply? We do not. You could just have him fired. You could have him break up with a girlfriend. He's down and out. And then he becomes Venom. So there's miles to go for very little payoff. What is right is Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy is bringing all his acting chops to this thing to try and pull it out of the bag, which he does, more or less. Were it not him and the same plotting, I'm blaming actually maybe the director on this one, but it's plotting, to say the least. And there's three different screenwriters, and clearly somebody came in to punch up the snappy dialogue between the two, the Venom creature and Tom Hardy himself. The two of them, there's the long shots where they seem to be improvising chatter to each other, which makes it for a highly comedic duo all of a sudden. So totally, this thing's all over the place. But yeah, that's the Venom. I could see it's a tough haul.
I'm going to celebrate actors and the work they're doing as well when I talk about A Star Is Born. First of all, now that I have seen A Star Is Born, will everyone stop telling me I have to see A Star Is Born? Please, for the love of God. And also, to all of you who said you've never seen anything like it, I have. It was called A Star Is Born, and it was called A Star Is Born, and it was called A Star Is Born. I've seen many things exactly like it. So this particular version of A Star Is Born, produced and directed by Bradley Cooper. That alone, kind of interesting. I was thinking, is he going to pattern his, like, kind of later career, his second act, off of maybe Clint Eastwood, right?
Yeah.
Because after Clint Eastwood started directing, his film was a little bit musically influenced. His first film was Play Misty for Me. And, of course, he was really drawn a lot of times to musical stories. And then I find out that this version of A Star Is Born was supposed to be directed by Clint Eastwood back in 2011, when Beyonce was set to star, and it fell apart. And it fell apart because it really actually took the involvement of Live Nation to come in to make this thing happen. And it is just a huge advertisement for all that Live Nation does. And they give me a lot of free concert tickets. So good work, Live Nation. But I will say this. I am not on board with the love train for this that everyone else is. It's getting great reviews. And this thing is exactly what they wanted it to be. I have no doubt that this is the movie that the people who made it wanted to make. I actually am willing to say that it is very, very well done, and not for a moment did I enjoy myself or the fact that I was watching this film, because there's nothing truthful in this movie at all.
Of course.
It is all fantasy. The depiction of the show business, fantasy. The romance, fantasy. I mean, even when Lady Gaga complains about how dirty the kitchen is at her dad's house, that's fantasy. Really? Just leaving butter out and a few spills of salsa in an otherwise immaculate and just built soundstage set is messy? It's all fantasy. And worst of all, the suicide at the end, which is the de rigueur ending of every A Star Is Born, is fantasy.
Right.
It's depicted as if, oh, man, if only this one mean person hadn't said this one mean thing to the guy, he wouldn't have killed himself. And that's not how suicides happen.
No.
So I'm a stick in the mud about this. I'm a gloomy Gus about this. I will not take the smiles off people's faces. If people love it, they love it. I've encountered a lot of people who don't love it, but that's why you don't love it. You either embrace the fantasy of it or you don't. That said, this thing is elevated by the performances by Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. They are doing great work. It's actually funny because I whispered to Lily at one point, I said, is Bradley Cooper doing a Sam Elliott impersonation? Because it really sounds like it. And I didn't know. that Sam Elliott was in the movie, and he turns up a little bit later as Bradley Cooper's older brother. So yes, he is doing a Sam Elliott impersonation and nails it, apparently, because I figure it out before Sam Elliott shows up. But
that's hilarious.
Their performances are quite winning, quite charming. They do a lot of the heavy lifting for this. But again, there's nothing real to this movie at all. I was reminded while watching it of the last, well, no, I guess it wasn't the last big musical success. That would have been The Great Showman or whatever. But La La Land, the last award hopeful musical, Damien Chazelle's La La Land. And I remember how that film I thought was not very good. And I rooted for it because I wanted there to get to be more original musicals. This is very good, and I'm rooting dead set against it.
Because it's not an original musical.
Nor is it truthful, nor is it... I mean, the music's original, though, so... But,
well, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, every generation sticks their top hits into this structure. And so in the 70s, you had Kris Kristofferson and Barbra Streisand putting in their hits of the day, and those spin off to albums. And then Judy Garland, James Mason were putting their songs in of the day, and those spun off to big hits. So it's ancillary. It's the very model of vertical market integration. Is it not?
I also, speaking of Damien Chazelle, I did see his return to form, according to me. First Man, the biopic of Neil Armstrong in the 1960s, and his involvement with Gemini and Apollo. And we will talk about it on next week's show when you are in Los Angeles, California.
Holy smokes! I'm coming, Los Angeles.
Let's close out the final Australian era episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with a lightning round of celebrity deaths.
Okay.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean Hagland, who was Will Vinton?
Oh, damn it.
Academy Award winning animator responsible for inventing a term in animation.
Rotoscope.
Claymation.
Claymation. Oh.
Perhaps his most famous characters are the raisins, the dancing raisins from the California Raisins.
Those guys, yeah.
A documentary about Will Vinton's life and career. Welcome to My Daydream. The story of Will Vinton is currently in production. He won that Oscar back in 75 with Bob Gardner for the animated short Closed Mondays. All right. A bunch of music personages left us recently. That I just wanted to mention, Jeff Emmerich, who was an undersung, underappreciated, but very important part of the Beatles sound, as he was the main recording engineer for the Beatles albums. Started out as an assistant engineer at EMI. George Martin requested that he become the main engineer on the Beatles albums in 1966. So he was behind the board for Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, Abbey Road, and then after the Beatles, he worked with McCartney, Elvis Costello, Badfinger, Cheap Trick, Supertramp, on and on and on. So that's about as good as that gets. Dean Hagland, who was Peggy Sue Guerin? Peggy Sue Guerin, Dean Hagland.
Wow.
She's dead. Who was she? The answer is in the name. Yes, you do. The answer's in the name.
Peggy Sue Guerin. That's the song Peggy Sue's written about?
Yes.
Peggy Sue?
The Buddy Holly classic was inspired by Peggy Sue Guerin. She was the girlfriend of Cricket's drummer, Jerry Allison. Buddy Holly had originally written the song as Cindy Lou. After Allison and Peggy Sue broke up, Allison asked Holly to change the name to Peggy Sue in hopes of getting back together with her. It worked. They reunited and were married for most of the 60s before he moved on to other palettes.
Fantastic. fantastic.
All right. We're around in third. We're heading to home. Legendary Chicago blues guitarist Otis Rush, known for his jazz-influenced and fluid style, which came to be known in Chicago as the West Side Blues sound, died. He was a major influence on many guitarists, especially Jimmy Page, Eric Clapton, and Carlos Santana. He first rose to fame in 1956 with his hit song, I Can't Quit You, Baby. Finally, co-founder of the Jefferson Airplane, Marty Balin, died. He, was responsible for, I guess, one of the most iconic psychedelic rock bands. Right. I mean,
right. Yeah, exactly.
White Rabbit.
That guitar sound.
And Somebody to Love. He left the group for a while, then came back to join the Jefferson Starship in the mid 70s. And he has left us. Marty Balin. So that closes our final installment, not only of the Chilpack Hollywood Hour morgue during the Australian era, but the Australian era itself is in that morgue.
Oh my gosh, so true. Well, I'm sure I'll return here, but it will be vacation only. I'm quite sure, since I owe $68 on my super, which is their 401k here. Somehow I am in negative dollars to my retirement fund, so I ain't retiring here.
Well, I also think when you go down under for your next vacation, the word that's coming to mind for me is pre-record.
Good thinking.
And you're going to be in LA, and we're going to be pre-recording a bunch of episodes for the next however many weeks. And so I'll be seeing you soon, Dean Haglund.
Can't wait. That'll be fun.
Everybody can find every show we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com. C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. That's it.
You know all the rest.
Till next week.
I'm in Los Angeles. I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Lernis. See you then.
See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.